Let's get started. Are we on? Yeah,
sort of.
Okay, so the first thing that I'd like to do now, because I think our enrollment has more or less settled out, is I'm going to project your name and what I think is your class name. And there's a few of you that didn't email me, so I'm going to ask you what your class name ought to be. And while we do that, you will also then know whether or not you are on the roster, because this is from this morning. So let me get this in a shape that you can see. You guys have a nice weekend?
Yes.
Oh, that's so good. Yes, I guess. There's been better. Okay. If you have like a lot of work you have to do and you get it done during the weekend, is that by definition a nice weekend or is that just a weekend? I couldn't tell what you said there. Nice weekend. Just a weekend. Wow. Just wait till you're older. 20 years from now, all you'll be thinking about is work. It'll be like, I just want to work. I just want to work. No, hopefully you'll not become like that. Can you see names yet?
No.
Okay. Oh, yeah, well, that would be, let's get this down farther. Are we good? Okay, we're going to move, this is A to Z, so could you, like, stand up and watch for a hand? I'm going to listen for a here, but they might pop up their hand, too, and then we can be sure that they're in the room. So can you call out nice and clear, because I want to just look here. I don't want to go like this. When I call your name, Anne. And stop me if this isn't the name that you want to use. But most of this is from the emails you sent me, so it should be okay. The yellow boxes are not. Hina. Yeah. Jessica. No, Jessica. Stella.
Here.
Lucas.
Hello.
Isaac.
Here.
Does that work, Isaac? Emily.
Here.
Tien.
Here.
Do you go by Tien?
Yes.
Okay. Qingche.
Here.
And you sent it like this with no space in between, but I don't know if you were just trying to follow my rules or not. Do you want space in your name, or do you like it like this?
That's fine.
Okay, then keep it like that. Remember to do that all the way through. Connie.
Here.
Jaibin. Jaibin. And what do you go by? Jaibin? Is fine. Okay. All right. Jinxi.
Here.
Jinxi? Oh, yeah, that's right. You're Victor.
Here.
Ivan.
Here.
Maurice.
Here.
Fiona.
Here.
Ayaka.
Here.
April.
Here.
Where are you, April? Okay. Oh, yeah, I saw you this morning. April's good? April is good? Okay. Bernice.
Here.
Bora. Jossie.
Here.
Miguel.
Here.
Sarah.
Here.
Jonathan.
Here.
Howard.
Here.
Eileen. Eileen. No Eileen. Whoopsie. She'd be like that. Okay. Michelle.
Hi.
Stacy.
Here.
Amria. Robert.
Yes.
Manning. Manning. He's absent. Okay. Robert Manning would be a good name. Alex. Dongjin. Hosun. Nikki. Oh. This I don't have a name for this person. I do have a Kim. What do you go by? As one word? Yeah, one word. Yeah, like that, or do you want a space in it? Is this good?
Yeah.
Okay. Johan.
Here.
Misun.
Here.
June. Deborah.
Here.
Harry.
Here.
Xin Dong. Christine.
Here.
Diane, we don't have very many similar first names, but we do, in the case of Diane, as we do. Diana L.
Here.
Henry.
Here.
Henry's good?
Yes.
Thank you. Adria.
Here.
Diana N.
Here.
Amador.
Right here.
Oh, and for the Dianas, this doesn't mean that you have to do that on your emails, but if we have some sort of chart, like a seating chart, you'll know which Diana you are if they're, because I put only first names on seating charts, so that's the only reason. Amador, Michael?
Here.
Michael's good. Amador, you are good, right?
Yeah.
Ireland? Elise? Elise. Tim?
Here.
Gio?
Here.
Where are you? Okay. RF?
Here.
Christopher?
Here.
Christopher, are you Chris or Christopher?
Chris.
You're Chris. I think, okay, well, you're not Christina, you're not Christine. Okay, Chris, you are. You, Chu.
Here, Patty.
P-A-T-T-Y?
Yeah.
P-A-T-T-Y. Like that? Wow, that's weird. You know, I was reading that aloud, like when computers read words, when you ask it to speak the text, that's gone into my subconscious as a style of reading. Ryan. Ryan. Sky. Nicole.
Nikki.
Oh, yeah, that's right. But I can't remember whether it's like that.
Yeah, it's like that.
Yeah, okay. David.
Here.
Christina. Chris. Oh, Christina. And is it Christina?
Yeah.
Okay. Aster. Aster-san. No, okay. Tristan. Oh, wait, what am I doing? Stephen.
Here.
Melody. And it's Melody, not Mel, according to your email, right? Yes, okay. Nancy.
Here.
Guanwei.
Here.
And? That's good? One word? Okay. Mina.
Yes.
Rachel.
Here.
Leticia. I took a wild guess on this, because the name's pretty long, but you're not here, so I don't know. Okay. Camille.
Here.
Patrick.
Here.
Dylan. Oop, Dylan. Cynthia.
Here.
Chow.
Here.
And? Chow's good? Thank you. Jason.
Here.
And that should be it. Did I miss somebody? There was another Kim, and I'm trying to think of her first name right now. It started with a K. Kaylin. It was Kaylin. Kaylin Kim, are you here? No. Okay. Then I guess you really are out. We exchanged like 20 emails, so I figured she's still in the class, but I guess not. Okay. That's one. Then we'll just do funny business for a second up there. This is, I think, something that you should write down. This is a timeline for the next few sessions. And and also when it comes to the section time, can you write this down too? Because I don't have this written anywhere. I just made it up as I walked over. So I want to say it and then hope to remember to do it. Okay, so today, Tuesday, we are covering the second of two segments on lyricism. Tonight, I hope and plan that I would send out poems and a short story that, as if you would like, you can take a look at and try to answer the type of reading question that I'm going to attach to that. And that is what you're going to be doing for the exam. So this is a dry run. And so you can, and there'll be a day later when we'll float answers. But, you know, you'll say, well, I think if I'd gotten that essay question, I would have said blah, blah, blah. And I would tell you how I react to that. So this is optional. You don't have to be in on the game on this. But I'm going to put out there some poems and some short stories for you to look at with a type of essay question I might ask, and you can give it a shot if you want to. Of course, you can sit down and work it out with your friends, but I probably wouldn't recommend that in this case because you need to be able to do this by yourself when it's test time. So that's going to happen hopefully tonight. On Thursday, we cover humor, and that there's going to be maybe more, it's prose, so it's going to be longer than the poems we've been reading. There may be quite a bit of reading for Thursday, but I could say as a larger issue that the humor and delight segment of this class is not that primary. So if you're squeezed on time and you're having problems getting through that, you can read it relatively quickly because I'm not going to hit it very hard. I just want to give you some a perspective that's a little bit different. So the page count may be long, but the expectations as to, you know, what you're trying to draw from it are not that high in this case. I just want to put out some examples of humor. And I mainly want to talk about the aesthetic concept okashi, and I need a context for that. And so that's where we are on that. Then on that day as well, Thursday, the humor day, I will show you, it'll take us 5 minutes, what the multiple choice part of the test will look like in terms of the mechanics of the test. I have an unusual system. Those of you that have been in my classes are used to this and you know what's going on. But if you haven't seen how I project questions side by side on a timed PowerPoint, I recommend that you be in class to see that because you'll be caught off guard when we start the exam. It may be, it'll be the first time you see it. It might be confusing to you. So it's a heads up that it would serve you well to be in class on Thursday and see that little practice run that we'll do. Then towards the end of this weekend, or more likely the first one or two days of next week, so probably Monday or Tuesday, I will assign a considerable reading that will be the basis for the questions that will happen on the midterm on Thursday. So you'll have 3 or 4 days to do that reading. That is in addition to the regular reading for the class. And what the idea here is that we're talking about approaches to literature. And so you're going to be asked to approach literature using those approaches for the exam. But you're not going to be able to sit here and spend the first 30 minutes reading a short story and then building an essay on it. So you're going to have the readings that will be the basis of the midterm ahead of time. You can read them with people. You can read them back and forth. You won't know what the questions are, but you'll know what the readings are. And then you'll have 20, 25 minutes with a single essay question on one of those readings. So those readings will go out to you on Monday or Tuesday of next week. I'd like to do it earlier, but I have a feeling the weekend's not going to be that good for me. So I'm just saying Monday or Tuesday, but I'll do it earlier if I can. Yes. You can, but it won't really help you very much because what you want to be doing, I'll go ahead and say this now. I was going to say it in a minute, but I'll say this now, is that we've been discussing some concepts like uchi soto from several different angles. We've been talking about lyricism. We're going to do that some more in terms of nature. And these are ways of thinking about literature, but, and here's the big but, is that when you're assigned something, what I would like to see you do with it is talk about what is really important in that particular passage. And that may or may not have anything to do with soto uchi or lyricism. So it's not a test that proves that you've got the concepts and that you can put these, stamp these concepts down on a piece of literature, regardless of what piece of literature it is. I can get soto uchi out of any damn cooking poem that you give to me, thank you. It's not that sort of thing. You read it meaningfully, and you have at hand, if you think it is a good idea, these concepts. So I will be looking for a balance between you kind of like rolling out, because you're not really getting the literature, so you roll out an approach onto the literature that just seems to crush out what's more important to talk about there. So because of that context, it's harder to say, well, I'm going to sit down, I'm going to read this literature, and first of all, I want to ask my friends, what's important about it? And you're going to get 10 people, 10 different answers. And so it's not going to help you that much. And so if you wanted to do soto uchi with this, what would you do with it? I think it's not efficient to, if I'm going to give you 15 or 20 readings to take a look at, it may be that many if we do poems and short stories, you can't really sit down with anybody and go over all 15 or 20 and get potential answers for all of those. Instead, what would be better to do is to read well, feel comfortable with the text, so that you're not blind to the text when I ask a question about that particular one. You know, it's like, oh, that story. I know that story. I remember that story. And so I think the best thing is just to read the material thoughtfully and ask yourself what's going on in there and be comfortable with the handful of stuff that I put out. I will assign more than I will test, for sure. And the questions will be scattered in the room. The person next to you will not be answering the same thing that you're answering. So you don't really know which text is going to be asked, but it won't be, you know, maybe as much as 50 pages. I want you to read some literature in stride, in larger pieces, instead of these example segments, and think about it in larger issues, and then be able to say something about that. So that's, I think you can, but I think it should be after you've read everything and you feel pretty good about it, so that you can go right to the place that you feel least good about. I think that'd be more efficient than just to line it up like that. Yeah. I'll do enough to jog your memory, but it'll be, you know, I'll put up the main characters, that sort of thing, so you don't have to memorize the characters, you don't have to memorize the, you know, those sorts of details, I think. But I may not practically be able to do it, or I might have rotating slides, because if I'm using six or eight texts, I can't put the information for six or eight texts up all at the same time. I may have it on a PowerPoint where every 30 seconds it flips to the next one like that or something like that. The definite concept here is not I will check to see if you've done the reading assigned. The concept is, can you think about it? I want an example of you able to think about Japanese literature, pre-modern Japanese literature, in some way. That's a whole different game than saying, like, let's assign Genji and I'm going to test you on Genji. And then you have to prep Genji in a completely different way than if I'm going to say, I want to see how you approach Genji, where you go, what you think is interesting to talk about, what you think is worth our time, that sort of stuff. It's not easy. But if you like literature, if you like talking about literature, it's not hard. We'll talk more about that as we get a little bit closer. Okay, so that's why, you know, the practice run might be kind of nice. Okay, so the next thing is, so that's the readings going out on Monday or Tuesday. Then on Tuesday, we're supposed to be covering Miyabi, which means courtly elegance. And on Tuesday, I will also then field the questions about the test and the practice, the dry run material I sent out. That will happen, so it's Miyabi plus test review day on Tuesday, and the test is on Thursday. And so next time, Thursday, we do dry run of how we're going to project the questions, but there's no real content there, just see what's happening. And then next Tuesday, after you've had the readings, had a chance to think about it and practice things, you can bring your questions in and we'll talk about the test in more detail on Tuesday, and then on Thursday we do the test. That's how it's looking. Then, and this is kind of a little bit relevant to what you said, on Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday of next week, not this week, but the next round of discussions, I have asked them to, they don't know this yet, I am now asking them to assign poems for you to read, bring in, and you're going to identify main poetic points within those poems. If you noticed on the reading today, on the Manyoshu section, on the PDF, I included a couple of illustrations. And I said above those illustrations that they are there because you can think about why, when this guy went about illustrating, where did he go in the poem? What did he think was most interesting in that poem? And that became sort of what the illustration was built around. So this poetry is definitely more effective when you kind of understand that central poetic point or that central poetic moment of some sort. So because nature and poetry, which we're talking about today, lyricism and poetry, what we're talking about today, and Soto Uchi, which is a little bit different deal, are not all that hard to apply to this. I think what is harder is actually understanding what is this poem about. And so I'm going to ask them to assign to you a handful of poems and then sit down with you next week and talk about those poems and bounce ideas back and forth as to why you think this is the most important part of the poetry that will flow into the way you need to do the exam. And the reason we're doing that is because the Miyabi section is not significant at this point. Miyabi is going to be very significant for us down the line when we do Yugen and later when we do Sabiwabi, and we come back to this. But the initial things I have to say about Miyabi are very simple, and the reading around it is very simple. So we can not devote the discussions to Miyabi. We can devote them to the reading of poetry. And on that point, what you're going to see over here is this is inside our B-Space folder. And inside our new materials that I've been building, I have already included all the material on poetry from earlier classes for your reference only, except now it's not for your reference only. Inside poetry, your GSIs will say, you know, I want you to read all of these are numbered, all of these are numbered, all of these are numbered. And they will say, I want you to read poem 17 on the Cocaine Reader. We're going to talk about that one. So you'll download the readers, you'll decide what poems you want to talk about, and then you'll message out to them, and then they will go to here, and they'll look at those particular poems. You can read all these readers if you want. They're not long. But and I want to drop haiku from that. And so Cocaine or Manyo poems, however many you think it works for your group. You know your group well. You know how their style of talking and stuff, and just think about how many poems you think you can talk about, and then you know assign a little bit more than what you think you can talk about in case some go flat, and do that. You'll practice reading poetry with your GSIs off of these. Is it good? Make sense? Okay. Moving on. So this is, I want to talk with about poetry with you and some other things. And this is basically the Lyricism 2 PDF, the long one, turned into PowerPoint slides. I pulled all the poems from that onto here so we could talk about them together. And so this is pretty much the content of that PDF that you already have and looked at, called Lyricism 2. And what I've done here is because, as you know, I've been moving around on the time scale. So I'm trying to create a sort of a reference point for you on slides so you know where we are in time. And this is, since you were to read Izumi, it's falling. These are not accurate. This is close to it, okay? It's within 37.5 years of it, one way or the other. So the slides will show you where we are in terms of the various periods. And I should say, by the way, just to reduce anxiety now, I'll tell you this on the test anyway, but in terms of factual information, because of where we are, I will give you a date. It'll probably be 1100 and say, you just need to know factual information that is ahead of 1100 because we move back and forth across the timeline. We talk about Basho. He's from the 1600s. You don't need to know him for the exam, that sort of thing. The test will contain to the timeline of what we're covering. We're mostly in the Heian period right now. We'll be mostly in the medieval period for the next segment. We'll be mostly in the Edo period for the next segment. So I'll aim the writings like that. Okay, so Izumi Shikibu diary, as it's translated, is really generally called Izumi Shikibu Monogatari. Well, it's called, it has two titles in it in the way that it was recorded, Izumi Shikibu Monogatari, which would mean the story of Izumi Shikibu, and Izumi Shikibu Niki, which means the diary of Izumi Shikibu. And the reason that's kind of interesting is that, as you notice when you read that text, it's written in the third person, the lady this, or the woman that. But we believe Izumi Shikibu wrote it. But we can't really absolutely prove that. And there is a possibility that she didn't write it at all. And that makes a big difference because she was had a scandalous life, and these are not private writings. So if she were writing this, and if she were writing this to try to gain a certain perspective from people about her, then she has a different motivation for writing this text than if it were written by somebody else as just an example of Heian lovers and how they get together through poetry. So that's true of, you know, like any memoir, you, like let's say, I don't know how many memoirs that Obama's put out yet, I don't know how many memoirs that Bush has put out yet, but you can be sure that in those memoirs, they're designed to produce a certain sort of readerly reaction. They're not neutral, they have their reasons for how they've been written. And Izumi would be the same way. She was really in hot water. She was became involved with somebody much higher rank than her. He treated her more with greater respect than people thought she was due. He even handed over control of his private library for a while to her, which is a pretty big deal, and installed her in a part of the house, which is inappropriate for somebody of her level. Those sorts of things. There's a lot of mumble, mumble, grumble, grumble about her getting together with this prince. So my reading, and it's just, it's still provisional because you can't prove authorship, but I like to take her as the author, and I like to take the text as being written defensively in a position where there's a lot of gossip about her and to try to produce a different sort of story about her. So if you've noticed on the PDF, I've got all of these sorts of notes there that are explaining the strategy of why she would say what she would say through there. I think that's a important thing to note, because although we talk about this genre, this Nikki genre, as a diary or journal sort of genre, it's more during this particular period in the Heian times where these women are writing things that others will read, and those others that read them are socially significant to them, not just anybody, then you have a very different sort of writing context, and you shouldn't think of it as a diary that's the honest private thoughts that is left inside a drawer for later or that sort of thing. They're written in a social context, communicating with the people around them. So I think that's an important thing to know about these texts. That makes them interesting, but it does qualify their sort of factuality. They're quasi-factual in content. So that's all I want to say about Izumi, because I've got other things to talk about, but I wanted to at least say that much. Then, as far as the Manyo poems go, this one, we're talking about lyricism. I'm going to get started on that in a second, but this particular slide I wanted just to put up because I wanted you to look at how the poem was originally recorded. Of course, it's not horizontal, it'll be vertical, but this is what it looks like, and this is what it looks like when it's written out into sort of regular Japanese. And so for those of you that are learning Japanese or know Japanese, you can go back and forth between these and see how complicated the system was. Some of these, some portions are have a more grammatical function to them, and this is an interesting use of saying kashikoi. This is to use this character, say kashikoi, means something. This is just to use for grammatical particle kamo, but it is the bird kamo, but you shouldn't think that there's any birds in the poem. It's just being used for sound and stuff like that. Except that it's, you know, it's a water-related poem. But so I just wanted you to see kind of how that's working, because it's pretty complicated stuff. Okay, then I'd like to make some general comments about the Kokinshu. We have three major poem anthologies that we discuss in this class. There are many, many more than this. And that's the Manyoshu, and then the Kokinshu, and then what's called the new Kokinshu later, Shin Kokinshu. And we've talked about the Manyoshu a little bit. And what I'd like to say about the Kokinshu, you can get a date at 905, or, you know, we don't know exactly. There's a little bit of controversy over that, exactly when it was finished and handed to the emperor. But right around 905, this collection was completed and became official. And this was written in Onnade, and that was a new thing. That's, I think, important. Its preface that that's at the head of the anthology is written in both Chinese Magana and in Onnade. They have two prefaces, one for each, so you can get this sense that we're still in a transitional period. The Kokinshu was shorter, a lot shorter than the Manyoshu, and more targeted in what was there. The Manyoshu was kind of inclusive, had diversity to it. The Kokinshu has a strong editorial hand and is making specific statements that, you know, if you're going to write a spring poem, your spring poems ought to look like this. This is what we want to see in our spring poems. This is what we want to see in our winter poems. This is what we want to see in our love poems. And there's a sense of a strong editorial hand in it, I think, as to the range of the feeling of the poems that end up in the text. So that I think for you guys, thinking backwards from this is more useful. And thinking backwards from this would be that if what does the kokinshu mean to the Japanese that you would be having to do things with in your daily life? And I would say that from that perspective, it's kind of funny because on the one hand, I think most average Japanese that aren't into literature the way I am will kind of get nervous. It's like, uh-oh, it is the classical language that I don't know enough about. Uh-oh, it's the classical. We read the Kokinshu in high school. I hated it. I don't remember anything about it. There's this foreigner asking me about it, and I'm supposed to know about it. And I don't think there's a lot of love in that context. I don't think they actually read and love the Kokinshu in a general sense. But on the other hand, the Kokinshu stands as an icon of great poetic achievements within the country, and there is pride associated with that. So they'll be happy to say that's a great collection. It shows Japanese sensibility. It was very important to our history. But personally, I don't read it. You know, I think it's kind of more like that. That doesn't mean that it hasn't had an effect, a real effect, on the way people go about thinking about nature now. I think it did. I think some of how your average Japanese, you know, they may say something about how beautiful, you know, we just had the harvest moon. Was that last night or two nights ago? Absolutely gorgeous. There are many Japanese, if they're going to comment on that moon, what they will say might fall within the range of what the Kokinshu would have liked them to have said, but they just don't know that because it's just become the way of talking about it and it's stayed over the centuries. So they may not identify with Kokinshu, but I do think the Kokinshu really set certain sorts of directions that were very persistent and run very deep in the culture. So it's worth thinking about. That being said, the Kokinshu, as it is thought of, is not the Kokinshu that really is. Just like Freud, if you know, most people think they know Freud, but if they talk about what Freud is, it doesn't match up very well with what his writings really are and what he's really thinking. But there's a popular Freud out there that everybody's ready to talk about. And that's true about the Kokinshu too. There's a Kokinshu in culture, and then there's a real Kokinshu with real poems, and there's a gap between those. But from your point of view, in terms of culture, that Kokinshu that people have created over time and which floats out there as a representative of something is kind of more important to you than the Kokinshu itself. But if you are into poetry and if you want to read beautiful poetry and you want to read highly polished, sensitive, excellent poetry, Kokinshu can mean something else. It's really a good collection. It's worth your time, just like the Banyoshu is and just like the Shinkokinshu is. There's some brilliant poems in there. But so there's that difference between, you know, how a culture might think about it and how you might be able to engage it in a way beyond what just a culture will say about it. It's definitely like that. And then as you work back in time closer to it, what it means in general has changed over the century. So you get a 1600 or a 1400 person talking about the Kokinshu. What they mean by that wouldn't be the same thing as somebody in 900 shortly after it was written talking about the Kokinshu. So it's not like one stable thing over time. But it's very persistent, it's very powerful, and it'll show up on all the lists. I would say that one of the reasons that I'm doing the approach I am in this class is because I think I'm getting more and more intrigued with an idea that we live in these sorts of multiple times, so that like I can be very modern over here when I'm watching, I don't know, I'm browsing YouTube and I'm just in some sort of random postmodern mode, and then I go over here and I've got a lecture about cooking poems and I get this traditional thing going, so that if you're going to write haiku, you enter into a certain tradition. If you're going to write a greeting card, it's a different sort of tradition. So these traditions persist over time, even though we're in the 21st century. What it means to write a waka or a tanka means shouldering a certain history. And so you have to decide, first of all, whether you're going to be in a traditional mode or in a more modern mode, because there are modern tanka. And so, but if you're going to be in a traditional mode, let's say that it has to be some sort of serious occasion, you step into something that's fairly persistent over time. So to say, like, well, we have this cocaine period, and then it's gone, and something else happens, and it's gone, isn't really true, because all these things persist through time, and you step into that space. I think for you guys, what's probably most familiar is your life on campus versus your life when you're at home with your parents. And you step into a different space, and you have a sort of a different you that's there, and it's a real you, but it's a different sort of thing than when you're on campus doing your own stuff. And there's a relationship, but there's some fairly different aspects to those as well. And I think that's true with a lot of these things. They persist. There's traditions. The traditions are valued in a certain context, and they're ignored in another sort of context. So given that, if we pop over here for a second, this is fairly typical. New Year's is a big deal for Japan, and there's all sorts of TV programs about New Year's when it's New Year's time, and some of those programs are the same year in and year out. And one of the things that's always the same is people standing around reciting traditional poetry. So I wanted to show you two examples of this happening on TV. Most Japanese probably won't watch this program. Some of the older Japanese will, but they'd like to have it on TV filling the room noise because it's just a traditional thing. It's like Jingle Bells. It just makes you feel like it's New Year's time. So this is that sort of program. And I've selected these two in part because we've got nature happening and because the preface says of the Kokinshu talks about song, song, song. And the waka that are, and I said that they're, you know, you stand up and you recite poetry. There's different ways of reciting poetry, and this is the most sing-songy of those styles. But I thought you ought to hear it. I haven't translated it. It doesn't really matter. But it's actually the poem that's related to Izumi Shikibu when the guy gives her the, which was really a cheap shot, by the way. He gives her the orange blossoms, and then she says, oh, it reminds me of somebody from the past. Do you remember that? This is that poem that she was quoting. And by the way, that was like really, you know, guys really are, whoever makes the first contact, whether it's guy or girl, taking a risk when they're interested in someone. You know, they call them up, they you want to go out? No. Okay, so you know there's a risk involved. Well, he kind of sideswiped the risk. Instead of sending a poem to her, he sent her a branch of flowers that requires a poem back from her. And that was, you know, that's like, hey. And so she turned it back around and said, okay, fine. Let's see what sort of poem you can write. That was basically the challenge back. And then got him to writing first. But that was really what was going on there was like, I really would like to send you a poem, but you know, I just don't know. You like my brother. I don't know if you like me or not. But here's this orange blossom that I know will make you remember that guy. And that guy is my brother. And brothers get kind of dibs on women, okay? So it goes like that. And then she answers, and then it got started. So anyway, so here we go. I need sound. It'll be over here. I'll just watch that. Nature. It's about azaleas, but they're showing clematis, but whatever. And then he's going to repeat it. and he's going to do that for 15 minutes. And then we'll be done. And they usually are standing someplace, you know, next to a stream or something like that. And it's that sort of, you know, sincere, clean, new year's. This is traditions. This is good. This is one of the things we do. And so in this context, the Kokinshu is presented as a revered text that's valuable to our traditions, and we're not embarrassed to have people standing around singing them on TV. It's a good thing. We like it. Or here's a less elaborate example. These were angry love poems. They're love poems, some of them. But I'll show you this one as well. It's a little bit different approach. Then she repeats the poem. Oh, no, she explains the poem. Because people can't understand the classical Japanese generally, so they have to explain the content. And then they went back and forth between guys and girls. People in traditional clothing, traditional background. Then you can see them, very traditional sort of setting. This is all putting our poems, Japan poems, within a traditional context, putting that right up front, New Year's time, we're touching base with their traditions and so on. Then over here, this is Tawara Machi reading her own poems. And Tawara Machi is a modern poet. She was known for, and we're not going to talk about her in this class, but Salad Anniversary was a poem anthology that sold millions of copies when it came out in the 1980s or whatever it was. And very simple sort of approach to tanka, and a very approachable tanka. But I wanted to show the connection with nature, because we're talking about nature today, in a modern tanka, that this is still persistent. And this is going to be, although, as you can see over here, let me adjust this to the screen. Over here, you know, you can see her reading. We're not going to do that poem. We'll just have her voice. But in this first poem, it's just nature. And she's going to say, cherries, cherries, cherries starting to bloom, cherries ending, blooming, a park where it seems like nothing had happened. That's the poem. Cherries, cherries, cherries starting to bloom, cherries ending, a park where it seems like nothing has happened. That's the content of the poem, if you can't get the Japanese. Sakura, sakura, sakura saki some, saki owari. 何もなかったような公園。It's very simple, and yet it, through the image of cherry blossoms, we're exploring something else about the rhythm of life, and that, you know, this is a park where lots of people come at different times for different reasons in their life. Some have kids, have lost their job and are sitting there. That's where they walk through that park on their way home from work, or whatever, all those sorts of things that happen in a park. But when you look at the park itself, it just looks like a park, and there's really doesn't seem like there's anything to it. But then when you layer in, but every year, yes, the blossoms bloom here, it's very beautiful, and then they end. And then for the rest of the year, it just kind of looks like a park. That gives you that sense of time and gives you a sense of thinking about all those things that happen there, even though it looks like there's nobody there right now, it just looks like nothing happens there. But in fact, something does happen there. And so it's a way of using nature imagery to kind of extend time, using the seasons and the change of the seasons to stretch out time and to include all of these sorts of activities. It's a pretty typical movement. Do you have any comments on any of that? Going back to PowerPoint. I think that's hard. I really like her, by the way, but I really like that sort of plainness of her poetry. But it's if you had to compose a poem in Japanese and you were given the first line, which was going to be sakura, sakura, I challenge you to finish it without looking like you just wrote a stupid poem. I mean, that's really tough. You know, you're already you've lost one of the three lines you get, and it's just said cherry blossoms, and now, you know, what are you going to do with that? I respect people that can do that. I think it's pretty remarkable. Okay. So, Kokinshu, by the way, there's a chart out there for you with the Manyoshu, the Kokinshu, the Shin Kokinshu on it. All the details are there. I don't think that they need to be mentioned in class because they're there. It doesn't mean they're not important. It means that class is for something else besides that. The other thing that I'd like to say about the Kokinshu, though, is that the positioning of poems within the collection is important. So the poems towards the beginning of the spring books will be early spring poems, and towards the end of the spring books will be late spring poems, and that sort of thing. But besides that, the relationship of the poem ahead and after it, there's sometimes something going on there. And so a good way of reading the collection is actually to read it consecutively and ask the question, why did the editor feel that this poem ought to come after this poem? What where's the bridge? Why is this poem the next poem? And why is this poem the next poem? There generally is some sort of an interesting but very faint sort of connection. It's not a simple connection. They call it nioi when they're talking about this in Japanese, but it's the fragrance of the poem, the smell of the poem, that it picks up what the next poem is. So the sequencing is very much a part of the structure of the collection, and that's true for all the collections, all the imperial collections. So it's not just a collection of poems in a shoebox. They're arranged for a reason. And the first poem is not the best poem. Generally, you want to warm up into a collection so you don't start out with a bang. It's a slightly weaker poem, and that makes number two look stronger that way. And poems that are very famous often have slightly less well-acclaimed poems, bracketing them to help them stand out a little bit more. And as you, maybe it bears repeating, but I'm using the Kokinshu to split the Heian period into two, because I think it's so powerful in its sensibility that I think it dominates the aesthetics and culture in a way. It's not the only thing there, but it's very important for this time. Okay, so the preface, very famous, especially the first line. Japanese poetry has a human heart as seed in myriads of words as leaves. And that, I wanted you to read that because here is an argument using natural imagery to make a very important statement. We have the first imperial collection of poetry, and I'm going to make my statement of what that is and what is important about poetry. And in that space, we use natural imagery to make the argument. And I was thinking about this coming over, but I think that the sense that I remember that, this was back a long time ago. It was some sort of environmental movement, and the logo for that environmental movement, this is in America, had these, little cutout people reaching around the world, all holding hands, and then said, "Save the world" on it. And I was talking to a Japanese friend about that, and he said, "I just find that the weirdest thing, because the world is bigger than us. We don't go around saying, 'Save the world.' There's the world, and then there's us in the world. And you don't save the world, you live in the world." And I think that there is, probably in a really deep sense, and I think that this is where some misunderstandings do crop up, this sort of an Asian sense where the world exists, the cosmology is there, and we are inside that. And it could work perfectly fine without us. It would go on forever without us. Humans aren't necessary for that to function. And so you get, like in Chinese paintings, you get those little people in the big mountains, and the sense that nature's kind of first, and people need to harmonize and match to that. And although we don't talk much about Taoism in this class, there is a sense that the natural world in the way that it operates is a truthful system, and that we, if we want to live sincerely and truthfully, understand that system and harmonize to that system. We don't change that system. And I think I don't think we as Westerners have that same sort of humility towards nature. Nature's kind of there for us to use in the ways that we need to use it. And there's a sort of a spiritual world that's beyond the universe, the physical universe, and that's important to us. So I think that there are arguments that, poetry is like the leaves on a tree. We read in the West as just, well, that's cute. Or, okay, fine. but you know, I see, I got your metaphor. Big deal. But I think there's, I think it's a deeper argument than that. I think the argument is that poetry is somehow very well situated to participate in the truthfulness of the natural world in some way. And I, the Japanese are very powerfully attached to, when they're writing poetry, you, working through nature as a way to understand things or to say things. So, for whatever reason. And we, that creates a certain body of poetry because of that. So I do think that it's better to take it a little bit more seriously. I remember in this one passage in Kagero Diary, which you read up through the long poems, and she was jealous about, you know, angry and jealous with her husband. She says at one time tearfully, she was planting these black bamboo, and she says, I wonder if some future woman living in this house will look at these bamboo and know what sort of life I lived here. And that idea that, that the black bamboo being planted by her and will live on after she's dead and will be cared for by somebody else can be a kind of a meaningful bridge between whatever she's suffering as a woman and what she thinks some other woman is going to suffer as a woman in a similar situation, and that the bamboo or the is the medium through which they can kind of spiritually connect, I think shows how seriously they take natural imagery as a way of making sincere statements and exploring things. I think it's, I think you have to kind of watch for that. That being said, as you know, on the PDF, I kind of gave you these three different ways of thinking about nature in poetry. That's a rough version. I haven't really thought about this before, frankly, but not in any systematic way. So I may want to eat my words later, but we're going to go with it for this class. So we have a nature imagery that's just being used as a metaphor, you know, soft as a peach. You know, that's just straightforward stuff. And then you have the Kokin authors really like to establish that they are very sensitive observers of nature, and poetry that is identifying small and subtle and requires sensitivity and attentive changes, and they can talk about that, are they're establishing their emotional intelligence, their education, and their poetic ability by identifying that. And quite honestly, I think I've become a much better reader of nature through loving Kokin poems. I think I've noticed a lot more. I think there's a lot you can do with noticing nature that you may not be doing because you kind of rough cut it, autumn, spring, winter, things, cold days, warm days, and stuff like that. And actually there's a jillion things going on with nature that are so interesting. And they love to look at that and all of those little changes and observe those and share those. And so that's something else besides just borrowing it as a metaphor, but talking about nature in its more complex and more subtle levels generally changes. And then you can turn around the other way and say, is there anything about the way nature behaves that can tell me about how I also behave inside myself? And there's a lot of poems, for example, about fading flowers, that love fades as quickly as flowers fade, so that the flower of your heart, if you're talking about the flower of your heart, you're talking about a feeling that seems to not be persistent and it's going to go away at some point. And so since there's a set way of thinking about dew and thinking about certain flowers, you can take that to yourself and say, is my life like the dew? And the dew is used as a metaphor for a lack of persistence in existence because it evaporates during the day and is gone. And when you say that about yourself, you're not saying the dumb thing that life is short. We all know that. You're not saying that you think you're going to die today, that we all know that could happen, but we don't really believe it. But what it's saying is something more sensitive. It's like, I don't feel like I can have a guarantee that I'm going to keep going in this world. I feel like I'm fading out. And this, so you often get these poems like when a love affair is coming to an end and you feel like you're dying inside because of it, and you talk about the dew, and that you feel like you're going to die on the spot, and nobody really thinks you're going to go and commit suicide about it, but what you're saying is that something, I'm losing a grip on this, I don't feel like the world's got substance, and that I can count on it, and that I can count on the future. And so I think instead of reading it as a simple metaphor, you need to take it the next level and say, Well, okay, if you're being subjective about it and you're talking about a fleeting nature, what does that really mean for you when you're thinking about your own fleeting nature? That's where the action is. It's not this sort of stock response that life is like a dew. Life is like dew. Spring has come. Does he mistake them for flowers? The warbler singing among branches deep laden with mounds of snowy white flakes. This is so classic, Coquin. This is a intentional poetic confusion. What's going on here is because it's an early spring poem, and warblers come out to sing in the early spring. It's early enough that there's actually still snow on the ground or snow in the trees. And so he's there in a snowy tree singing. But since he's singing, you think it must be spring because birds sing in the springtime. So does this bird think that all of these little tufts of snow that are sitting on the branches are the white flowers of the plum tree? That's what's going on there. Got that? And yeah, April. Yeah, so there isn't any. This is just sweet. Okay, this is just charming. Yeah. Yeah. Well, okay. So, all I would like to say at this point is that in the mode of the banquet poetry that I mentioned before, where people are making poems to be shared, in many circumstances you want nice poems. And they don't have to be very much of anything. They just need to be kind of nice. This poem is part of an extension. There's a series of poems on warblers confusing snow for flowers. That got started as a little sub-thread of poetry written at this time. So what's going on here is, okay, he's working with a typical poem setup. What has he done to this that's a little bit different than the other poems? So the poets at the time are appreciating those mild variations within a scene, and we're just picking it up. You know, that we don't see that part because it's English translation, so you can't see the virtuosity of the poem through this. But if you had all of them lined up and you started studying them, you might be able to say, wow, this poem does actually do a little bit better job than the others do in that, and that's cool. He's cool at that. So these poems, I think have a poetic agenda substantively, and then everything else is kind of carried along like that. But I think in the larger picture is that beware of thinking that poetry is coming from here, because a lot of this poetry isn't. It's coming from out here. All the other poems that have been written like this, I'm going to join the party and I'm going to write my poem that's like this poem. It's not me and the thing. And that creates a different sort of context. Or, blossoms of the plum merging with the radiance of moonlit night, if we could make sure of them, we must seek out their fragrance. This is I think this turns on the idea of what it's like to smell things at nighttime, and begins to play with the idea of fragrance plus light. Is there a relationship between light and a smell? You know, it's crossing over the senses like that. But these are, I think, fairly straightforward poems for that. In the bigger picture. Following the stream dotted with scattered petals, I searched for the flowers only to learn that springtime had taken leave of the hills. I explained this in the PDF, but what's going on here? Okay, so let's say that you hop in the car Friday. Okay, let's say that you had to do some stuff first, so you leave late, or somebody in your group was late. You're going to go to Yosemite. You're going to have a camping trip in Yosemite, but you guys can't get out away from campus until like 5:15 because one person was late. Okay, so you finally get in the car. You drive through all the traffic in San Jose, you know, blah blah blah, and all that sort of stuff. And you finally get to Yosemite, but it's dark, right? And so you've never been to Yosemite before. So whoever's driving is. You move in to Yosemite and you set up camp. It's completely dark. It's very dark because you can't really see the stars because there's mountains out there blocking the stars, but you don't know that because you haven't been to Yosemite before. But it feels like it's a different season than what you left. It feels like it's autumn. You left, it was summer, It was summer when you got in the car, but it's autumn when you get out there. It smells like autumn. It feels like autumn. It feels like another season. In the mountains, the seasons are ahead of the mountains that are here. So this is a poem about knowing that if you were to go up in the mountains, you would be in autumn, but you're down here, it's still kind of hot and still doesn't feel like autumn. And that sensitive statement that, you know, the season doesn't come once everywhere at the same time, it creeps in little by little, starting with the higher places and the valleys and the dark valleys especially, and you feel it first there, and then later you're going to feel it here. That's the idea, and then the proof of that is because these maple leaves have fallen from the tree up in the mountain, and they have gone down the stream, gone down the stream, gone down the stream, and gotten to you. And you say, whoa, there's a maple leaf. Our leaves are green. This leaf is red. It must be autumn in the mountains. And then what makes it beautiful is that no maple leaf can really do that. I mean, if you know, it's never going to make it from the mountains to there. You know, they just are going to get stuck way up there. So that unreality portion of this adds, something nice about the poem. It's not just a mundane statement of a discovery of a leaf. It's a poetic visualization of what, if this could happen, it would be so cool if it did happen, type of thing. Yes. Yeah.
Almost all of these poems, I'm thinking like, okay, he saw a woman, but by the time he got close, you know, springtime,
yeah,
taking leave of the hills.
Yeah.
And the previous one, like the fragrance versus smell, like
yeah. The
appearance of a woman versus the essence or something.
Yeah.
Like that. But you favored a more lighthearted interpretation of that part.
Right. So you're a romantic guy. So here we go. Kino Tsuruyuki is the compiler of this collection, right? He's sitting next to you, and you're saying, you know, I want to put that poem in the love books. And he's saying, no, that poem goes in the spring book. And you're going, no, look at this. This is beautiful. This is romance. And he goes, no, this is nature. You know, okay, there's a little romance in there, but it's really about nature. The power of this poem is about nature. And you two would disagree. And he's more powerful than you, so he would get his way. But if you were more powerful than him, then you would get your way. And you would be making a statement in the flow of Japanese history that we can stretch into metaphors of romance fairly easily, and it is okay to read romantically. But the real tradition has been conservative about that and tends to stay towards nature and lets it go into romance when it seems a little bit more obvious than this. So the reason that I'm interpreting them the way I am is because he has placed them in the books of spring and autumn. But that's the placement. And there are other poems. If you read the love books, you will see poems in there that are nature poems that you'd say, yeah, I see that too. So that's how it works. It's exactly how it works. Yeah.
So in your opinion, if you didn't read this in the spring book, would you think it's a
love poem? Okay, so I'm a romantic guy too, all right? I would like to read everything as romance. I don't have a problem with that. I can turn commercials into some sort of romantic narrative. So, but I know that I'm not typical in that way. So if the question is, can I do this? The answer is yes. If the question is, would readers of the time, if I'm trying to read as readers of the time did, does this approximate what they did? The answer would be no. They're trained to stay, they're less speculative, they don't tend to read a lot into symbols, they stay closer to the practical meaning of poems, and they don't go this far, generally speaking, especially in the Kokin period. So, but that doesn't mean you can't. And if it works for you, it works for you. You know, why not? Yeah.
But generally, they should have a direct reference to a person like eyebrows or, you know, lover.
Not necessarily. Yeah. Not necessarily. I think not. We'll read the love books after the first midterm, and you can see for yourself what you think. Yeah. For chrysanthemum, there's a season of splendor. Other than autumn, they but increase in beauty after their color changes. And this is, I don't have the picture here, but I have the picture on the PDF where, you know, chrysanthemums, when they fade, go into these very cool colors, which is true. Go look at me. Don't throw your chrysanthemums away when they fade. Just watch them change colors. They go through some very cool colors. Ours in their front entrance are white, but when they die, they turn lavender. And then they go from lavender to orangey sort of stuff, and then they go to brown after that, and then they're dead. But they don't go straight to brown. They go through these colors, and they've noticed that, and they like that, and they like to talk about that sort of careful observation of the changes in nature. It's pretty typical. You're shallow like a stream. Going on from there. Shingo Kinshu. What do I want to say? I think it's interesting that there's 300 years of Kokinshu before there's, and there are many collections written during that time, imperial collections made, that do something within the Kokin way, and there's some things that are counter to the tradition as well, but it wasn't really until the Shin Kokinshu that we got a collection that became the sort of go-to collection for people as the gold standard for how poetry should be. That's 300 years. That's a long time for one collection to... That's a really long time for one collection to kind of be at the top of the pedestal. The Shinko Kinshu comes into being for lots of different reasons, but I would like to say that in part it's because the politics have changed. I think the Heian period comes to an end. How things are being... how business is getting done in the capital is a lot more complicated. We have a fractionalization of the scene. We've got factions vying for each other. There's a lot of things going on that I think creates an opening for a new collection. There's some personal things as well. Some of the people that were involved in making it are just very, very smart, dynamic people, and I think that they could go shoulder to shoulder with Kino Tsuruyuki, who did the Kokinshu, in terms of poetic excellence and scholarly knowledge and all of that. But for whatever reason, we do have a collection. Shikon Kishu is a larger collection. And I am a Heian person. I know the Kokinshu pretty well. I've read a lot of Shinkokin poems, but I've never fallen in love with the Shinkokin the way that I love the Kokinshu. So I don't see it in quite the same way. I don't think I see it with quite the detail that I ought to. But as a general comment, I would say that what I do like about this collection is it's, first of all, it's polished. These poems are really, really well written. They're just real gems. I think that there's something about that. They've been writing poetry for a long time. They've been, you know, tweaking it for a long time. Some of these poems that were written about that time are really just good in terms of the I don't know, something gem-like, silky-like, well put together sort of feel to them. But they also tend to be, and this is what you had brought up, they tend to be a little bit more willing to be a little bit more abstract. We're not talking about abstract poetry, but if you look at something like this, on the spring night, my floating dream, bridge of dreams has broken away and lifting off a far peak, a cloud bank trailing in the sky. And this poem has a lot of different meanings to it, but in part, this is written by Fujiwara no Teika, who I'm going to talk about in a second, maybe. But the Floating Bridge of Dreams is the final chapter of the Tale of Genji. And this poem, in a sense, is talking about what it feels like after having read the 1,000 pages of the Tale of Genji and coming out of that misty, romantic, dreamy world. And I think a lot of you have had that experience when you read a book that you really, really like and it ends, and there's just kind of a special space for a little bit, and then the world comes back in, and now you're back to the ordinary world. And this is that special space deal, but you can see it's disappearing as you watch the clouds floating away. It's like pretty soon is all going to be gone. So it stands on its own as a good poem in terms of nature poem, but it does a very good job of talking about what it's like to read the Tale of Genji as well. So in this sense, we have a more abstract reading. Teika's willing to do that to some degree. Teika, I think, is a really brilliant guy. His father was one of the initial editors of the Shinko Kinshu, and they were different sorts of people in ways. Teika's a little bit brasher, but I like his poetry. He's a very romantic guy. He writes some strong poems. He's worth your time. He was... his father worried about him because he was really, as the story goes, and I'm sure it's been polished over the centuries, but he was much more into kickball than into poetry in his younger years. And his father is really buttoned down, sort of conservative guy. And I think there was some concern and some sort of, you know, difference of approach. But Teika did become involved in poetry, was a brilliant poet. And also, by the way, he copied by hand most of what was then considered the canon of the day, the major texts of the day. And only people with connections could get their hands on texts. And he had lots of connections. He got his hands on a lot of texts. And one of the things that he did that wasn't really being done up until his time, when you're recopying something, is if he got to a space where he didn't understand what was on the page, or if it was already missing on the page, instead of just making something up and filling it in, he would make a margin note and say, it's blank here. And that was wonderful to scholars to finally, you know, okay, we know at least here that there was already a gap in this text in the year 1200 or whatever it was. And because he actually made these scholars' notes, and his versions are still important texts for us. And there a lot of them are there, but As I Cross the Bridge of Dreams, Sadashi Aniki, he loaned it to a friend, and they didn't give it back, and we don't have his copy of that, which that's my field, and I really regret that we didn't have one, because I wish we had had his hand copy. But a very reliable guy in terms of his scholarship, but forward-leaning in his poetry, some good poems. This is another one of his. Blossoms of plum perfume my sleeves with their scent, vying there for space with shafts of sparkling moonlight spilling down through the eaves. And this is like absolutely gorgeous. We've got some sort of embroidered kimono, and you can imagine beautifully embroidered, very complex, elegant, courtly clothing. And then you get this context where there's an aristocratic smell, that the robes have been scented. They already have a scent. And the with that scent is the scent of the plum blossoms. Plum blossoms, by the way, if you don't know how they smell very nice. They're a little bit easier than orange blossoms. They're a little bit more delicate. But he imagines these smells competing with the light that's coming down from above. So you have this mixture of smells and light, and they're both trying to be as beautiful as they possibly could be in the space of this beautiful brocade. And that is just a really nice frame of mind to think about. It's like, wow, first of all, my brocade is gorgeous, and it's got moonlight shining on it, and it's got plum blossom fragrance doing this other thing, and it's busy right here. And it's just really beautiful way of bringing things together. Then, skip that. Fushikaden, at least read the first couple of paragraphs of that, just because it's just really weird stuff. We'll talk about it again later, but I think you just take a quick look at it. And then, wow, we'll get 5 minutes on haiku. Okay, so we talked about choka, the long poems. We talked about waka, which were also called tanka, in the 31-syllable 5757. And so what the haiku is, in the short version, is that in the much later down the timeline, 1300s, 1400s, we have a practice called linked verse, which is a writing in couplets like this in a community setting where the paper goes around and you add your verse as it goes around the circle. And there's rules for this. And it's a very, it was a really popular way for literati to spend time together in writing linked verse. And it could be 100 lines long or 1,000 lines long. And one of the rules of linked verse was that the first poem, the initial series, ought to be strong enough as a poem to stand on its own, if the rest never happened. And that first set, because of tanka, is 5-7-5-7-7, 5-7-5-7-7. The first set was 5-7-5. Chop it off there. That becomes a 17-syllable haiku when it stands on its own, and it's taken as a poem in and of itself, not part of a larger work. It's then called a haiku, except at the time, it was called a hoku, meaning the first verse. So back then, they called these hoku, not haiku. Haiku has a fairly complex history as to why it got to be called that. But in any event, the 17-syllable haiku that you know is a shortening of the tanka that you know. But not just in any old context, in the context of linked verse. It was supposed to be the first one, supposed to stand on its own. That's the origin of haiku. And the other thing I would want to say about that, I'd really like you to know, I'm struggling with the clock all the way through this particular lecture, but the is that you've probably been taught of haiku as a simple form because it's only 17 syllables long, but there isn't anything simple about writing 17 good syllables. And real haiku are that have been really well written are almost like, you know, rocks that have been jammed together and there's just no way to move them anymore. It's like you couldn't find a syllable that you would like to switch to another syllable. It's not going to work. You can't switch any, you can't move anything around, you can't do anything with it. I think of haiku as really katai, really compact, structured things like this. And I think of tanka as sort of long and loose with some openings in it, and there could be other ways to do it. And they're much more looser in their structure, and there's space in there, and there's different directions you can go. I feel haiku are kind of like boiled down. And so I think an appreciation of haiku is to appreciate how long it takes to get to the right 17, and that once it's there, it's kind of like there. You couldn't come in and just change it a little bit. It's just going to be so hard to do that. And the haiku will have, this is because it's an introductory class, I have to at least mention, needs to have a season word in it. These are predefined. Skunk is not one of them. There's 3,000, 4,000 season words, and you can select from those, and one of those, there's dictionaries for that, and one of those has to be in the poem. And then there's usually a top and a bottom, like ancient pond, frog jumps in, plop, right? So that's the ancient pond is the top half of the poem, and then getting from the ancient pond to the action, there's what's called a cutting word in between those to define a top and a bottom, and bringing the top and the bottom together is part of how you understand haiku. Unfortunately, translators don't always know that, so they blend the two together, and it's harder to read in the translation, but that's basically the idea. So there needs to be a season word, and there needs to be a cutting word, and it needs to be 17 syllables, generally speaking, they have a specific moment context, and that's a seasonal thing, and that helps you understand what the poem is. Not easy going. And one last poem, and then we'll go. The summer grasses, monuments to the dreams of fallen warriors. Back to lyricism. I haven't talked about lyricism at all today. So he's traveling. He goes to this place, okay? And in this place was where the defeated troops had retreated to, and they hung out there for a while, and they recuperated there and all that stuff. And instead of giving you the history of, you know, 1300s and 1100s, what he does is he goes to this this summer field. He looks out at the grasses. He looks across the field, and he sees grasses poking up like this, you know, across the field. And that makes him think of helmets that look like this. You might have seen these on our fierce Heike warriors. And he sees a field of helmets of fallen warriors. And that he thinks of the beautiful, verdant, rich, and wonderful season of summer and the end of the dreams of all these people that fell and died and the blood that seeped into the ground and the spirits that stayed there. And he brings a contrast between this summer imagery, which most of us would enjoy, and that. And that's a lyrical moment there. That's a way of looking like that. I'll see you guys next time.